Can you name Canada's current ambassador to the UN? Stay tuned for the answer to that question and for lots more questions than answers. In less than 2 weeks, from September 14th to 16th, the largest summit meeting in history will convene in New York City to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the United Nations. 2005 is also the 5th anniversary of the Millennium Declaration. So when more than 170 heads of state converge on the headquarters of the world's most representative multilateral organization, the plan is for a working celebration. In fact, substantive, not to say arduous, preparations have been underway for several years. For just a few minutes, let's follow the bouncing ball through the hallways of the world's largest bureaucracy. In 2002, Kofi Annan commissioned the Millennium Project to develop a practical plan for achieving the 8 Millennium Development Goals agreed in 2000. They are to eliminate extreme poverty and hunger, achieve universal primary education, promote gender equality and empower women, reduce child mortality, improve maternal health, combat HIV, malaria, and other diseases, and to ensure environmental sustainability and establish a global partnership for development. Headed by Professor Jeffrey Sachs, an economist from Harvard, 265 leading development experts worked for 3 years to outline realistic investment strategies and approaches to financing the Millennium Development Goals that will allow even the poorest countries to achieve them by 2015. On November 4, 2003, the Secretary General, Kofi Annan, appointed the High-Level Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change to propose ways of strengthening international security. The panel was made up of 16 former heads of state, foreign ministers and security, military, diplomatic, and development officials from both the North and the South. On December 2, 2004, that high-level panel published its report, A More Secure World, recommending 101 changes the UN and its member states need to make in order to confront challenges to peace and security. On January 17th, the Millennium Project report, Investing in Development, delivered a 3,000-page analysis of the progress to date on the Millennium Development Goals. Sachs told the UN that the world is far off track on the commitments adopted in the Millennium Declaration back in 2000. 600,000 people still die each year of measles, a disease for which we have an affordable and effective vaccine. 2 million people die each year from tuberculosis, 3 million from HIV/AIDS. Every 3.6 seconds, another person dies of starvation. Most are kids under 5. Canada's ambassador to the UN, Alan Rock, concludes that, quote, when it comes to saving lives, while the UN has demonstrated an ability to respond to natural disasters, it does far less well with the other kind, which are also within its responsibility, those human-created disasters from civil wars or domestic conflicts that produce killing fields, mass atrocities, or genocide. It's a failure that undermines the credibility of the United Nations, he says. If we add the problems like the breakdown of the relationship between the UN and the government of the United States, if we add management issues like the Iraq Oil for Food program, if we add allegations of criminal misconduct by some peacekeeping troops in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, these are difficult days for the United Nations. End quote. The government of Canada responded to the crisis in September 2000 by establishing the independent International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty. The commission's report was the culmination of 12 months of intensive research, worldwide consultations, and deliberation. It was published in time for the high-level panel to endorse what it called the emerging norm of the responsibility to protect. How do we reconcile the concept of a state's sovereign right to govern what goes on inside its borders, with the moral imperative to protect people when there are mass atrocities or ethnic cleansing. The Commission suggested a shift in language and therefore in concept. It recommended that we no longer talk about the right to intervene. Instead, it speaks of the responsibility which sovereign states have to protect their own citizens from avoidable catastrophe, but which, when they are unwilling or unable to do so, must be borne by the broader community of states. The Secretary General took the reports of the high-level panel and the Millennium Project, added input from governments, from member states, from civil society, and on March the 21st of this year, produced his own report, In Larger Freedom, which has been used as the blueprint for an outcome statement to be negotiated and then submitted to member states for adoption at the Summit of World Leaders to be held this month. That negotiation is happening right now. In his March report on UN reform priorities, Annan urges heads of state and government to embrace the responsibility to protect as a basis for collective action against genocide, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. Then on August 17th, enter John Bolton, newly appointed UN ambassador from the U.S., with 450 last-minute changes to the action agenda proposed in the draft outcome document. Bolton is controversial. During Bush's first term, he dismantled the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, renounced President Clinton's approval of the International Criminal Court, and blocked efforts to add a verification clause to the Bioweapons Convention. As the Undersecretary for Disarmament Affairs, Bolton oversaw U.S. participation in the recent Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference that took a week and a half just to set an agenda. The United States has been a regular participant in the negotiations for the upcoming summit, so diplomats were surprised to learn that Bolton had, at this stage, circulated a document proposing to eliminate most of the latest draft and suggesting line-by-line reconsideration with all 191 UN members present. The proposed changes include deleting all 35 references to the Millennium Development Goals, a particularly devastating exclusion to the developing world and to women. Beijing and Beyond, a coalition of international women's groups, points out that, quote, the United Nations has been a galvanizing force for women in the past 2 decades, facilitating their efforts to define a comprehensive global agenda, end quote. The U.S. also proposes to delete all references to nuclear weapons states' disarmament responsibilities and all references to small arms controls and to climate change. It proposes to weaken wording on government's responsibility to protect civilians in cases of mass killings. The Japanese ambassador, Kenzo Oshima, told reporters, "I think there is a general sense that these comments come rather late." On the other hand, Bush is among those expected to attend, although he has not formally responded to an invitation. Some see all this as routine diplomatic maneuvering, but Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, believes that, quote, the Bush administration has given the United Nations a stark choice. Adopt the U.S. changes and acquiesce to becoming an adjunct of Washington and a tool of empire, or reject the changes and be consigned to insignificance. But Bush gave the UN these same 2 choices once before, in September 2002, when he threatened the global body with irrelevance if it did not embrace his call for war in Iraq. On that occasion, the United Nations made what Bennis calls the third choice, the choice to grow a backbone, to reclaim its charter, and to join with people and governments around the world who were mobilized to say no to war. It was the beginning of 8 months of triumph in which governments and peoples and the UN stood together to defy the U.S. drive toward war and empire, and in doing so, created what the New York Times called the second superpower. It's time for that three-part superpower to rise again, she says, to defend the UN and to say no to empire, end quote. In a speech this January, Ambassador Rock put it in more personal terms, quote, "Above all, we must never doubt the practical importance of the Security Council and the work it does. I can recall when last summer I rounded up like-minded people and I spent 2 weeks going from office to office, visiting 8 members of the Security Council, trying to persuade them to act more vigorously in Darfur. At the end of the process, I felt some days as though I had nothing to show for it but a lot of lost shoe leather." Rock continued, "But you know," he said, "in October, one of the NGOs in New York brought to the United Nations and then to my office 2 women from Sudan who'd been active in organizing on the ground, women who'd lived through the horror that's gone on there. And these women told me when I met with them that they were personally aware of every word in the Security Council resolutions. They'd received them. And they were passed around hand to hand in the camps. They told me which parts they thought were most effective. They told me what encouragement they drew by seeing that the world had not forgotten them, that someone was thinking about them, that steps were being taken. And however modest it was, the steps taken by the Security Council made a difference." End quoting Alan Rock, Canada's ambassador to the UN. That's it for this Monday. If you would like to suggest a story or comment about anything you hear on Monday Morning World Report, email Earthling, that's EARTHLING, at netidea.com. I'm Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening.